Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hello? Hello? We're almost there. All right. Hey, long time no hear.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing well. Super excited to hear you again.
Well, I'm alive. That's about it.
Oh, man, I hear you.
Yeah, we're a couple minutes early yet anyway, so...
Well, I'm going to start recording in about 30 seconds. No, actually, right now.
Okay.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to a special edition Wednesday night, here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're pleased to bring back an information provider from some of our past shows, returning again, very excited, on the subject of credit cards, Mr. Michael Maris. My name is Martin. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two things are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on and virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social a network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Well, maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. I mean, for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedy to the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over here at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator's screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at Your Remedy Is in the Law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at Your Remedy Is in the Law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy Is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I thank you for that disclaimer and sharing with us all the ins and outs of Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight is the discussion regarding Mr. Slevin's LLC, a unique LLC above all other LLCs that I've ever investigated. Now, there are two things that I want to cover first before Mr. Slevin comes aboard. And one is the application of what Bernie calls his golden horseshoe, which up until this point was a very, very expensive proposition to engage in. You had to spend about $35,000 to properly create different entities that would generate what visually looked in a flow chart like a horseshoe rather than something like a circle. Because it's a horseshoe, where you begin and where you end are never connected at the top. So that was $35,000. What Mr. Slevin has brought to the table is a way to initiate the golden horseshoe without spending the $35,000 to begin with, but rather by spending $7,500 and having this most unique LLC crafted for you, a turnkey operation, if you would, where you come up with your business, whatever it is, your business name, your business model, et cetera, share that information with Mr. Slevin's team, and you'll end up in very short order having an LLC crafted that on its own face negates, in law, the tax consequences of doing business with the IRS at the end result having their hat out looking for money. It's gone. You couple with that, instead of you putting forth yourself as the creator, if you would, or the having 100% of the value of the LLC, if it's rather divided into two charitable religious trusts to begin with, that you are the trustee to, you're further securing your position by having two entities that are, by the IRS definition, non-taxpayers. So this is a wonderful arrangement of your affairs. I'm so excited that we have this. We will be forever adopting Mr. Slevin's LLCs into the greater program we call the Golden Horseshoe. It's a great way to start and a great way to finish with it. The second application that I want to point out to you is any one of you who is an employee. You work for somebody. You grab a paycheck. Mr. Slevin has a program by which you can have an LLC created, and this LLC is who your present employer would actually hire instead of you. Of course, you're still showing up for work, but he's writing checks or she's writing checks to the LLC, on a weekly basis, a monthly basis, whatever you agree to, and you're actually netting more money out of it than you were before while you were an employee, and you're not paying taxes. Furthermore, the burden of you having to try to convince, if you would, your employer of going this route, that has been mitigated because Mr. Slevin has a team of people that actually communicate directly with your employer so that they can present things in such a light that economically make more sense for the employer to hire the LLC than it is to hire you under your Social Security number as a taxpayer. So, without further ado, it is my sincere pleasure to turn this call over to Mr. Slevin and let him get into some of the nuts and bolts of this and perhaps reinforce some things that I've brought up. Mr. Slevin, you there?
Yes, Michael. Thank you very much.
Hey.
I'm using my standard voice.
I'm shocked. I was getting ready to go groan and stuff, but no. Mr. Slevin,
well, you know,
how much have you matured in this week? I'm overwhelmed.
Well, as I promised my wife of over 43 years now, the one promise that I have kept is that, baby, it'll never be boring. So.
That's right. You got me beat by 2 years.
Oh, thank you. All right. Good evening, folks. So here again, I'd like to start out with a little history to give you the basis for what we do. And we're going to touch on some other extraneous things that have something to do with it, but just want the audience to understand. We've done a lot of study in this, a great deal of study. I often talk about having a couple of PhDs and studying this venue, and I noticed some people when I commence to expound upon the situation, they kind of just go, their eyes go blank. So with this little bit of a history, maybe that won't be the case. So the Organic Documents of the United States of America, the nation, which is a union of independent free countries. That's what the 13 colonies came to be once they announced their independence from the monarchy of Britain. They came to be 13 independent countries, and they formed a union, a compact, if you will, and they were the states, and a state can be a subdivision of a country or a country into itself. So the Constitution of the United States, excuse me, the Declaration of Independence set up a, that's the wrong paper, set up the emancipation of all of the of all of the 13 colonies. And the statement of that devolving of the I apologize, I got some technical difficulty here. Here we go. What the? My computer is revolting. Here we go. My apologies. So the Organic Document was the Declaration of Independence, and it took in a lot of the sovereignty of the people to become sovereigns among themselves. Okay. So again, the Declaration of Independence is a masterful work, and it's a work of reason. And when you define reason, that is a way of logically and succinctly going from point A to point B, so nobody can say that you just jumped there of intuition or guessing. The word reason comes to us in the Bible from Isaiah 1:18, and it says, quote, "Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool," end quote. So this fantastic visual process of setting what is perceived to be a wrong, because, and the general word is, we are all sinners, and the sin is like scarlet or like blood. All of that can be made right. All of that can be made well through reason. And so when we declared independence from England and the monarchy thereof, the sovereignty that was presumed to be the divine right is the word or the phrase that was used by the monarchs of Europe. They have the divine right to rule over you, to be your sovereign. Speaking of the people of the United States of America or the original 13 colonies. And so this feudal system that had been lasted for millennia was dissected by the Supreme Court in Chisholm v. Georgia. This is a 1793 case, and at page 471 it says, quote, "The same feudal ideas run through all their jurisprudence and constantly reminds us of the distinction between the prince and the subjects. The prince was a sovereign. Everybody else was a subject. No such idea attains here. At the revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of the country, but they are sovereigns without subjects. Parentheses, unless the African slaves among us may be called so, close print, and have none to govern but themselves. So there we are, all sovereign in our own right. We own everything, and ourselves particularly. And the last sentence says, the citizens of America are equal as fellow citizens, as joint tenants in the sovereignty, end quote. So we ascended, we the people, ascended from a dominated position back to our original position with God-given rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is nothing more than having our property and using our liberty with our property to be successful in life. That's a good way of saying the pursuit of happiness. So that consistent way of thinking about things, we, our forefathers, and anyone naturalized into the United States of America by whatever method, ascended to this position of sovereignty, but with no subjects. We own ourselves. We own our production. And the only way that that can be taken, that can be traded away, I mean, it can always be taken by violence and under certain circumstances. So we leave that portion out because that's the definition of criminality. But the only way we should be able to use these productions is via trade, which is voluntary trade, value for value. However, the right to contract, which is every trade is a contract, either verbal or written, the right to contract also gives us the authority, the power to contract away our rights in trade for something that we perceive to be worth more than them. I would suggest there's nothing, but you know, every man being his own person, and I use man as a short for mankind, every man being their own person, their own sovereign, if you want to give it away, you got, you know, there's others that will take it. So the Constitution of the United States was officially ratified and approved on June 21st of 1788. Now, some 3 or 4 years later, December 15th of 1791, America ratified the Bill of Rights, which are the first 10 amendments of the U.S. Constitution. And this really should have been labeled the Bill of Restrictions. Because just if you just go down and read it, it's plain to see, you know, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And just to go over what infringement means, so I'm sure you've seen the American flag with the field of blue and the 13 stripes and the 50 stars. That is the way it's described in law. I believe it's title either 2 or 6 of the United States Code. Anyway, the gold fringe that has been placed around it in many settings like federal courts and other institutions like that is a military symbol. It's not the flag of the United States of America. According to law, it is something that has been added to, but it's a gold fringe, and it's a bunch of little threads. So the term infringe simply means to pull one of those thousands of threads off of that gold fringe. That's what infringement means. And so the government was specifically told by the framers of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to not take one thread from the right of the people to keep and bear arms. They were absolutely serious about it. But as people will, that restriction has been overcome in many circumstances. And outright banned the keeping and bearing of arms has been outright banned to many people, many men. So the Bill of Restrictions, we'll talk about them, puts the government in its place. You shall not do this. You shall not do that. You shall not do this over here. It's all restrictions on the government's activity. So had they set with that, that would have been fine. But, you know, people are what they are, and they're always craving for power. And the psychopath is the ultimate power grabber. So in 1871, 90 years later, there was the District of Columbia Organic Act. Now, this is an act of Congress that repealed the individual charters of the cities of Washington and Georgetown, which lay within the 10 miles square ceded from, I believe, Maryland and Virginia. And so it revoked those charters and instilled one new territorial government in the whole of District of Columbia. And we'll refer to District of Columbia by D.C. for the rest of our talk here. So, and it also incorporated, because that's what a charter does, of a charter of a city like Washington or Georgetown, that charter incorporated that city. So this Organic Act, in fact, did an incorporation. They still called it Washington, but the D.C., the District of Columbia, is a proper name. And one of the trailings of that is it found at 28 U.S.C. 3002 definitions. As used in this chapter, United States means a federal corporation. What that consolidation, incorporation, and new charter did was put D.C. into a city-state. The two other well-known city-states are the City of London, which is a one-mile square enclave in Greater London, United Kingdom, as well as Vatican City, which is a 110-acre parcel near the city center of Rome, Italy. These are distinct, separate nations within other nations and also called city-states. Now, these people that inhabit these city-states and the controllers thereof truly believe that they own everybody and everything. And they enforce that belief with merciless efficiency. A little evidence that that D.C. ascended to a city-state was it started acquiring foreign property. In 1898, the Spanish-American War broke out, and the use of Pearl Harbor grew to great importance. So D.C. acquired those islands, the Hawaiian Islands, and some other smaller named pieces as a territory from Stanford B. Dole of Dole Pineapple, who had stolen it from Queen Liliuokalani in 1893 with the assistance of about 300 Marines. So D.C. was the thief that got the Hawaiian Islands. As a result of the Spanish War, D.C. also acquired Cuba, Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Cuba, which was set free almost immediately, that may have not been the best thing for them because they still suffered from the Castro Revolution of the 1950s. The Philippines escaped D.C. in 1946, and it's still a mess. Guam and Puerto Rico remain territories of D.C., and there's some rather interesting agencies headquartered in Puerto Rico, one of being the Internal Revenue Service. And this is found in various pieces of legislation as well as other books. And a friend of mine says IRS stands for It's Really Satan. But I digress. Nonetheless, D.C. became a city-state by adopting a constitution, and it looks very much like the Constitution for the United States of America approved in 1788, but for one little word. The document adopted by D.C. is the Constitution of the United States. And so when we look at Wikipedia and we find this quote, two of the most commonly used propositions are of and for. These two, like all prepositions, indicate a relationship between objects in a particular sentence. Of is considered an Old English preposition, and it means away or away from. The preposition for, on the other hand, initially comes before, from before, which also means on account of. Therefore, the city-state of D.C. can be seen as away from or without the union known as the United States of America. And I'm sure several of you are going, what? So all of this word salad or obfuscation, if you will, are done by people known as lexicographers. Some other words may be called a legislative draftsman. Now, a lexicographer, or a lexico for short, are wordsmiths of the nth degree. And we know from our military days, though, if it ain't written down, it didn't happen. So the Supreme Court has some words about lexicographers, and it comes from a case called Merchants Loan and Trust v. Simtanka in 1921. At 28, it says, quote, in determining the definition of the word income thus arrived at, this court has constantly refused to enter into the refinements of lexicographers or economists and has approved in the definition quoted what it believed to be was the commonly understood meaning of the term, which must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. End quote. So lexicographers, legislative draftsmen, they all have to write things to obfuscate what they really mean. Because as we'll talk about a little later, the constitutional taxation that is on we the people is very specific and very simple. So a little bit more about the lexicographers, a way we can judge the understanding of English language comes to us from a thing called the Flesch Index, and that's spelled F-L-E-S-C-H. It runs from 1 to 100, and it measures English understanding. So as an example, a standard newspaper is written at about 8.5. The first-year college student understands about 11, and a law school graduate comprehends about 15. The tax code in particular is written at an average of 33 with pieces as high as 55. And as we go forward, one of the ways that they obfuscate this is they define words and phrases as a term in legislation. And when they do that, you must use that definition when reading that particular legislation or statute because Webster's is no longer applicable once that term is defined in the statute. So this is more of the mystery and the obfuscation, camouflage, and outright lying that has been placed upon the tax code, if you will. And so to show, again, how really simple it is, we look back to the Constitution, and the Constitution for the United States designates two great classes of taxation. And the great classes line is Supreme Court. The first is direct, which is applied by apportionment. The second is indirect, which, according to the Constitution, must be uniform throughout the several states. That's it. Direct and indirect. Those are the only classes of tax in the known universe. Now, there's three taxable categories. They are people, property, and activities. As far as we can find, there's nothing else outside of those either. So direct taxes are applied to people and property via census, enumeration, and valuation. What that means is a census or enumeration is you count all the people and count all the noses, and everybody with a nose pays the tax. And it is a flat tax equally Every head pays the same amount. So the indirect and the, the property is valued. So, and you know this probably from your county taxes on your home. The property is valued, and then the legislative body of that particular jurisdiction says, okay, you're going to pay 0.001% on that value as tax on the value. And so the owner is therefore liable for that direct tax. So that's people and property. So we have, only thing we have left is activities, and that is under the indirect taxes. And it's probably best described as an excise in order to mentally differentiate it. Instead of direct and indirect, we'll say direct and excise taxes. The excise is placed on activities. Now, anytime that you have an activity, in order to tax it, you have to measure it by measuring the output, measuring the times it's done or whatever. So that has come down into two ways. You either count or calculate the activity, or you put a flat fee on something necessary for the process. So something I often use the example of finger waving. And if you can imagine your index finger being waved up and down, so if, which notably would be a privilege, so if the government wanted to tax finger waving, they would either have to hire somebody to count how many times you waved your finger, or they would put a tax upon the finger as the measure or as the necessary component of the activity of finger waving. Another example of that is asking this question: is there an excise tax on whiskey? Whiskey being distilled spirits. Well, no, because excise is only on activities. Whiskey is actually property, so there can't be an excise tax on property. But it can be a measure of an activity, and of course the activity would be the distillation. So the tax, even though it says there's a tax on whiskey, that is the measure of the activity of distillation. Or, so that's why you see bottles of whiskey having a tax stamp on them to let the public know that this item has had its tax paid upon it. And so you would have the revenue agents would count how many bottles came out of the distillery, and that's where the tax would be placed upon those bottles, or a flat fee on the capacity of the distillery. Either way, it's measured, and everybody seems to be happy when it's paid, except the people that pay it. So the 16th Amendment, if we look into this, apply this to the 16th Amendment, it says, Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes, comma, from whatever source derived, comma, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. So we do a diagram on this sentence, and it rules out a tax on income being direct because it says it's without apportionment. So that takes direct out, and then they double down on it without regard to any census or enumeration, which are the three components of the direct tax. So this power must be to lay and collect an excise tax. And that's exactly what they did. They passed this in, I believe, in July of 1909 and sent it off to the states for ratification. And then since they had just granted themselves this power, they wrote the revenue law of 1909. It was passed and signed into law, I believe, August 5th of 1909. And the law says, or the statute says now, that there is hereby imposed an excise tax upon income with respect to carrying on business in the corporate capacity or doing business. Now, carrying on business or doing business is best described, in my opinion, as the buying, selling, handling, or holding of goods. Now, goods can be tangible and intangible. So, a blank piece of paper would be a good. It is physical. It is the paper itself. It is usable for many different things. If someone were to, like Beethoven, were to write a symphony upon that piece of paper, that is a representation of the music, and it is therefore intangible. But the difference in value of a piece of paper or several pieces of paper versus the value of a Beethoven symphony is absolutely extreme. So those are the tangible and intangible goods. So you can buy them, you can sell them, you can hold them, or you can handle them. And the holding and handling would be classified as services. So doing business is the handling, buying, selling of goods and services. All right. So the excise is upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity, the 1909 Revenue Act. So we have this set up, and that came before Congress and almost immediately because it was an excise, it was put out all in the several states, and a whole bunch of people got upset by that. And it came to the Supreme Court in a case called Flint v. Stone Tracy, that was first started at the end of 1910 and re-litigated a little bit in 1911. So this is what it says in Flint at 151, quote, "The tax under consideration, as we have construed the statute, may be described as an excise upon the particular privilege of doing business in the corporate capacity, i.e., with the advantages which arise from a corporate or quasi-corporate organization, or when applied to insurance companies, for doing business of such companies." And at 152, it says, "If business is not done in this manner described by the statute, no tax is payable." Also, a little further down in the case, it said specifically that private firms, private individuals, and private partnerships are not subject to the income tax imposed by this statute, and synonyms for not subject are not liable for or immune. When we stop about immune and exempt in law, immune means just that. It's not subject to it, can't get it, doesn't apply to the organization or person that is part of this. However, exempt in law means that the legislator has laid out this tax and you are subject to the tax. But in the legislator's largesse, for whatever reasoning, they are going to exempt you from the penalty of the tax. So it's immune and exempt are extremely different. So all of that comes down today, as far as the private firms, private individuals, and private partnerships, comes down today in Section 701. And it says, quote, "A partnership," this is 701 of the Internal Revenue Code, "partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter," period. Now, this is Chapter 1 of the Internal Revenue Code, and it's titled Normal Taxes and Surtaxes. That's because in the 1913 revenue law, the Congress labeled the taxes upon income as normal taxes. Now, that's not shenanigans. I have no idea what is. So So the first part of that chapter says that there are clearly states that this clearly states that some folks are not subject to the income tax. Now, the second sentence of 701 says, persons carrying on business as partners shall be liable for income tax only in their separate or individual capacities. So that shows that the subject of the tax upon income is carrying on business, just like the 1909 law said, and that the people behind it are liable. If they're carrying on business, of course, that would be carrying on business in the corporate capacity. And there's a great case, I believe it's out of the 9th District, somewhere around 1917, and it's called Haiku Sugar versus the tax collector, Mitchell or something like that. Anyway, what that came about was talking about a group of seven corporations back in 1903 came together to form a statutory partnership and were in the sugar business. And they were doing lots and lots of good business and making big profits. And then the profits of the partnership were distributed among the partners, which were corporations. So the tax collector got up in 1916, I believe, the tax collector got up into their face and said, hey, you owe tax on this, on these profits. And it went to the original district court, said, yeah, that's true. And then it went to the appeals court in the Ninth Circuit, and they said, no, it's not true, because the 1913 law specifically states that there is hereby a tax upon income imposed on United States lowercase c citizens and corporations called the normal tax. But partnerships, which is a business form, are not subject to it because, as we said in Flint v. Stone Tracy, they are immune to that thing because they can't partake of the privilege of doing business or carrying on business in a corporate capacity. So this the second sentence here plainly reorients that the subject of the tax is carrying on business in the corporate capacity, which is measured by income, which is revenue minus deductions, and that's it. And the liable party are the owners of the corporation and or officers. And that's it. And we know that to be true because from after Flint v. Stone Tracy, every time it says there is now a tax on income, it started off at 1%, and then it went to 2%, then 5%, and now it's a variety of scale, a graduated scale. So in the 1935 Social Security Act, which was written in 11 separate titles, we find the tax imposed in Title 8 and Title 9. Title 8 says, without reference to any other taxes, there is hereby a tax imposed upon income with respect to employment. So, yeah, well, everybody thinks, yeah, I'm an employee, I work for somebody. Well, not in law, because like we said before, if a term, a word or phrase is defined as a term in that particular legislation, you have to use that definition. And in the 1935 Social Security Act, we look over here in Title 11, and they define the term employee, which is a component of employment, and it says the term employee includes the officer of a corporation. That's it. Now, everybody goes, well, yeah, that includes it. That means, you know, engineers and clerks and secretaries and janitors, which are all employees of a particular corporation, that includes them too, because that's a list. Wrong answer, because the very next section after the term employee includes the officer of a corporation, they redefined includes and including. And so Let me get down so I can read this. So they redefined it like this. The terms includes and including, when used in a definition contained in this title, shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise when the meaning of the term defined. So if you diagram that sentence out, actually that comes from today's code at 7701C. But there's double negatives in there. So the terms includes and including shall not be deemed to exclude. So that's a set of double negatives. Other things otherwise is another set of double negatives. And then of the meaning to term defined. So at least two, and there's possibly you could say it was three. Here again, this is written at the Flesch index scale of 33. So when you take out the double negatives, what it says is the terms includes and including are only within the meaning of the term defined. So when you define a term such as the term, this is from 7701A1, person, and it says the term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, estate, partnership, association, company, or corporation. So in the tax code, when they say person, do you see any human there? No, it's an individual. An individual what? That is not a designation of a man necessarily. A trust, a state, partnership, all these are labels under which man does business or has accumulated goods. So the term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, a state, partnership, association, company, or corporation. But only those things are the term person, and it doesn't say man or human there. So is a person a human? Not in this piece of legislation. It simply says that. So we've come down to, we now have the basis for what the income tax is. It is an excise tax upon a particular privilege, which is doing business in a corporate capacity, measured by the income, which is nothing more than revenue minus deductions. Okay? So the income is the measure, and the subject is the doing business in corporate capacity, and then the statement of liability is normally who is imposed upon, but it is the officers and the people in the corporation which are working directly under that umbrella. And private firms, private individuals, and private partnerships are immune from it. And just a little bit about that, this is one of the places where it says that. This is Dole v. Mitchell in 1918 at page 185. Excuse me, Dole v. Mitchell Brothers, and it says, quote, whatever difficulty there may be about the precise and scientific definition of income, it imports, as used here, something entirely distinct from principal or capital as a subject of taxation or as a measure of the tax, conveying rather the idea of gain or increase arising from corporate activities. And it goes back to refer to Stratton Independence, which was right after the Flint v. Stone Tracy. And he says, as was said in Stratton Independence v. Hobart, income may be defined as gain derived from capital, from labor, or from a combination. Okay, so capital is the means of production. It buys the parts of the production, and then the labor puts the production together. So that's what from both combined means. So we have the situation where the income tax under the 16th Amendment is an excise, It's only on doing business in the corporate capacity, which is a particular privilege measured by the income, and the offices of the corporation are the particular people liable to pay out that tax. So we've now discovered that the excise tax is upon the activity measured by either a specific piece or the production of the activity, and then the integral owner of that is liable for it. So I think a couple of weeks ago we talked up about sales tax, which is probably the other tax in this world that affects just about everybody. So what is sales tax? Is it direct or is it an excise? Well, unless you go and read the individual state legislators, you don't understand this. And because it's written by lexicographers, you still don't understand it. But basically what it comes down to in one form or fashion of every State of the Union that I've addressed so far is that it is a excise tax upon selling at retail. Selling at retail is a licensed activity. So when Walmart comes into a new area, they have to get a sales license from the local taxing authority. So they are permitted to sell at retail via this license. So the sales tax, so the legislators made this a licensed activity, where no license should be, because you just got one set of people trading goods for another set of people with another set of people. So the sales tax is now on that transaction of handing over a product for Federal Reserve notes or cash, if you will. So the merchant, in this case Walmart, is the liable party because they are doing the transaction. They are providing it, and then the customer is paying them. But what happens is the legislature, in their sales tax law, which is disguised very well, indemnifies Walmart, the merchant, from collecting the tax from the customer, so the customer can't sue them for collecting something that is not their responsibility. The customer does not have a liability for the sales tax. The merchant does. And so you see that, and I'm sure you've seen things where it says, hey, we'll pay the set, when they're having a big sale or whatever, Black Friday, go, yeah, and we'll pay the sales tax. Well, you darn right you are, the merchant, because that's who's liable for the sales tax. You're doing it under licensed activity. And in some states, the legislators gave a goodie to the merchants, so they will collect 7% from the customer on each transaction, but they only have to send 6.5% back up to the taxing authority, so that they reap the benefits for being nefarious and paying and passing on tax that's liable for them to the customer. So that's just an aside for that. So what we have in the century-old law now is partnerships and corporations, which have been around for millennia. Your corporations go as far back as at least the Roman Empire. And partnerships have been going on since there was more than one or two people doing business. They came together and formed an effort under a single name. So when you have a corporation, and all of these are known as forms of business. So the corporation, it has multiple officers. Are titles of officers, such as president, secretary, board of directors. All of these are officers of the corporation. the corporation itself is owned by the shareholders or stockholders. So the officers of the corporation decide how many shares of stock they would issue and sell to the public and or keep it privately to other men. And then those shareholders have voting rights so that they can tell the board of directors and the other officers what their wishes are for the company to do. So that's how the control mechanisms. And of course, as we had talked about earlier, the profits of the company, of the corporation rather, are then dispersed to the shareholders. And just to use round numbers, we'll say that XYZ Corporation did business and it had a profit of $1 million, and it had 10,000 shares out there. So it decides some of that profit needs to go back into business, but what we'll do is we'll pay $1 a share dividend to the owners of those shares. And so each owner of however many shares got that many dollars. So so that's the language of corporations and the owners and the managers or the officers. So in partnerships, you have the two types of officers are general partners and limited partners. And then instead of shares, they own it via percentages of membership. So one partner will have 10%, one partner will have 8%, and so on and so forth, up to 100. However, that can also be broken down into sub full percent. So you can have a tenth of a percent or a hundredth of a percent in order that you have more men involved in the ownership of the partnership. So in 1977, somebody got the great idea of bringing together the corporation, the best parts of the corporation and of the partnership. And they called it a limited liability company. So this limited liability company was formed via statute in several of the states, and they changed the language so that anybody reading about this form of business would understand what's going on. So the language in an LLC is that it has one officer title, and that is a manager. And you can put whatever you want in front of it. It could be chief executive or bottle washer manager or whatever, but the manager is it. But the company can have as many managers as it wants. And then the owners of that limited liability company are the members. But here again, you can break that membership down to sub parts of 1% so that you can have, 10,000 members or 100,000 members, whatever, if they all had one piece of that membership. So that's how you, when you're reading this type of stuff, you understand that you're dealing with membership and dealing with either an LLC, a partnership, or a corporation. And there's a bunch of other names that they tag onto these types of forms of business, but those are the base three. So all of that being said, what our company does is once we contract with an individual to build one of these companies, and we call it our product, we call it a private firm from the Flint v. Stone Tracy case. And so this private firm is based on a limited liability company organized in the state of New Mexico. That's because somebody wrote this really cool law, and I'm sure they got paid for it, in which there are the application to organize a limited liability company in New Mexico is called the Articles of Organization. There are a minimum of two parties required on that form, and they are the organizer and the registered agent, both of which can be other LLCs. So that doesn't take much brain power to say, okay, so you've got an LLC that's owned by an LLC that's owned by another LLC. And this is the structure, to put it simply, that our company has been able to construct. What that does is when we contract with a client to build this structure, one of our people goes to the Secretary of State, fills out the Articles of Organization, and gets, and we'll use the term XYZ LLC. That's the name applied for. Secretary of State says, yep, you're good. Here you go. And they give us a certificate of organization, not a article incorporation, but organization, which goes back to Section 701, where it says, a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter. And then they redefine the term partnership over in 7701A2, and it says, in part, a partnership includes an unincorporated organization. And what we now have in our hands is a certificate of organization. So that just is a quick way of how all of this ties together in the Internal Revenue Code. So once we get the certificate of organization for XYZ LLC, then another party of our group goes to the IRS and gets an EIN, which is Employer Identification Number, which is a form of tax identification number, a TIN. But when they go to get that, they get it for banking purposes only, which is one of the five, well, there's actually a bunch of different reasons for doing it. But so when you when they get this banking purposes, the subtitle says, select this option if the reason for applying for the EIN is strictly to satisfy bank requirements or local law. Did you hear anything about taxation in there? Nope. So our personnel do the articles of organization, get the certificate of organization, then get the EIN issued to the XYZ LLC in our example. At that time, that person applying for the EIN is known as the sole member. The sole member on the IRS paperwork then holds a meeting and commissions a third person as a manager, the only officer of the limited liability company. And so now there are three pieces of paper in existence: the Articles of Organization, the EIN, and the commission as manager, otherwise known as a letter of authority. So now that guy or gal who's on that commission puts those three pieces of paper together, takes it down to a local bank, and gets XYZ LLC a checking account. This is all done under our company's names and numbers. Once that checking account is established, then they bring it all back to the office, and our back office personnel put it together and make sure everything works. So we've got the account, money goes in the account, it gets a debit card, checkbook, and all the other accoutrements for that. And then so the money is moved around, and there may be more than one checking account or other account involved in this situation, depending on what the client desires. Puts it all together, puts a pay-as-you-go cell phone with it, which is pre-programmed with the electronic banking information, and we like to include Square app, which is a point-of-sale interface, and Cash app, which is a peer-to-peer transfer, as well as quite a few other things. It's some very powerful capabilities within those two applications. So we put that all together, put it on the cell phone, make sure everything works, box it up, and ship it to the client privately. Because on the Articles of Organization, our company is listed as the organizer. And since no other information is filed on that, the organizer is considered to be the owner. So when the gentleman or lady that went down and got the EIN for it as the sole member at that point, when that's issued, then they transfer ownership back to our company. And that company then privately transfers the ownership to the client. So obviously our mission is to build as much privacy and anonymity of the client into this product. So when the client gets this product, opens the box, they pull it out, and they can now do business, carry on business under this name, in our example, XYZ LLC, without anybody knowing or connecting them to this company. And so the mechanisms by which that is done, and they receive a manager's commission as well as part of the package, and how that going forward, so that in our case XYZ LLC can then do several things. They can just do business by meaning buying and selling and handling and holding of goods, or they can hold assets for the client, so the house, the car, whatever, can be put under that umbrella. And then so the client then has full control because they have papers showing they own XYZ LLC, but they don't have to tell anybody unless there's something comes up. And so the assets can be then put in there. Then as far as that would be classified as an estate at that point. And that estate can be then transferred to beneficiaries by the simple mechanism of the beneficiaries also having a commission as manager. And so on the incapacitation of the principal at whatever level, the original client, the beneficiaries can just step in and continue to run the business under their commission as managers without any probate or estate tax. So that is a quick three things that we can that these private firms can accomplish. And as Michael said earlier, it can also interpose itself as the employee between in the employer representation and eliminate the income tax in that particular transaction. And I hope that gives some explanation to a very convoluted thing. And we didn't do it. The Lexicos did. But we just figured this out and are able now to offer it to all you good people. And our business motto is we strive to make you as successful as possible. So what are your questions?
All right. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for our show tonight. We're going to open it up now for Q&A. Press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand, *2. And we'll start with Ron in just a moment. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll notice that there is a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side to the center right of your monitor. Left-click into it, begin typing your comment or your question. On the outside, underneath, you'll see a place to put your name and some other information and hit submit. And I'll be glad to give voice to that comment or question for you. So we'll start with Ron in Cocoa, Florida. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes. Can the client, now the new owner of the LLC, open additional bank accounts?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the assets and liabilities thereof, cars, houses, whatever, are those all under the same LLC? Or are they under separate standalone LLCs within the parent LLC?
It all depends on the size of the estate. There's a guy out there named Robert Kiyosaki who I started studying back in 2000. And he teaches how to invest, and his forte is rental properties. And so one of his suggestions, which is how we got into this whole business, was he suggested if you have multiple rental properties, then they be titled like, say you've got 9 rental properties, then each 3 of them would be titled under a separate LLC. And here again, this is all dependent on the value of the properties. because what you're doing is you're mitigating risk by doing that. So that you've got nine properties under three separate legal identities, that's exactly what an LLC is. It is a separate legal identity from the officers or owners. So if one of those LLCs had got a judgment against it, all that the judgment could access would be those three properties that it's titled under. The other six properties in our example would be not at risk. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that was my presumption. Just clarify.
Yep. Hello?
Yeah, is that the end of it, Ron? Do you have any other questions?
For now, yes.
Okay, thank you so much. All right, again, press star 2 on your keypad. We don't want to make an early call out of this. That's not good for our hosts who likes to be able to tell us these good things. I like to be able to hear them. Press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to have an early call tonight. I'm surprised Kent hasn't hit the button. He knows how to do that. No, Kent's got great questions. The guy he thinks five steps ahead on things. Anyways, well, if this is the end of the call, it's going to be a shorty. I'm going to check Freedom's Radio while you think about pressing that button one more time. Refresh over here. No, that's it. All right. Well, I want to, Mr. Slavin, thank you so much for an awesome presentation. Got a good recording of this. And I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. Sorry you don't have more questions for us, but it's pretty self-explanatory. And I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to employing it with what I'll be doing very shortly. So, Mr. Slavin, thank you again. We'll see you next week. And we thank you
all
for joining us this evening. Yes, sir. And good night. And be well.
Good night.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.